Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
Because growing up is being wrong makes you grow up.
Yeah.
Like being, eating shit grows you up. Like that's why kids grow you up, I think, because kids are just like, kids don't give a shit. Like they shit their pants and they're not waiting till you're done with your inspiration. They just shat their pants and that's your fucking problem.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map. Welcome back to Curious Creatures. This week, we continue our conversation with LCD Sound System founder, James Murphy.
You guys come from an era and a grip of artists who just killed the B-song.
I mean, when I mention B-sides now to, like, say, students in the college, they kind of look at you curiously because they're not quite sure what a B-side is, you know, why it would be anything special. Because every A-side, every track from an album that was pulled off, of course, had to have extra tracks for the B-side of the 12-inch platter or the 7-inch or the cassette.
Like the B-sides of your guys' bands, it was like really like it was an opportunity to do something crazy.
Right.
You're already in bands that normal people think are crazy people.
Right.
Like it's already anti-commercial in a certain way that somehow manages to be successful. And then you get the B-sides and you're like, all right, well, this is just full on the Humming Wires or Carnage Visors. It's just like literally just like crazy music, which for me, like my favorite stuff always. Like I loved that stuff. Like, because it was also a way for like partially musically, I loved it because it was always freer and weirder even than the music that drew me in.
We did our B-sides at John Fox's studio in Shoreditch, Garden Studios.
Yeah,
and we go in there on a Friday, and we come out on a Monday morning, Sunday night. And we knew we had to get the B-side, extra track for the 12-inch, and maybe one other. So we had the premise of three written, recorded, mixed, usually with whatever was lying around in the studio as well. You know, if there was a kind of piano, or for Humming Wires, Einstein Zender Neubarton left all the metal work.
You leave the grinder as well.
Just big scaffolding tubes and bits of metal. You just worked on the spot, really, hoping you'd finish by Sunday night.
When we'd finished Pornography and we went back and we started, we thought, okay, the band fell apart and it was just me and Robert, and we decided, well, okay, we'll make a single. And to get the B-side, I end up just like playing the stairs in the bottom of Island Studios, like what was that place called, The Bunker or somewhere. They'd done a lot of reggae stuff. It just smelled like dope everywhere all the time. But we were like, okay, well, now we're going to do the B-side. Okay, so just play the stairs, Lol. Play the stairs. I played the stairs, recorded that, put it through a whole load of stuff. Yeah, we were allowed to go nuts. And we do the sort of things we would do in rehearsals where we were just having fun. You know, we weren't all sitting in the corner with, you know, tears and candles all the time. You want to do something that excites you, you know, that you just have fun.
I think that's key. The way where we come from, the gang mentality, the the exclusivity.
Right.
That's also the point, because if you don't have that, how can you be open enough, you know, naked enough, if you like, to be able to put you out there if you don't trust the people that you're with implicitly? You know, it's why the idea of making a band like, oh, we'll get the best drummer, best guitarist, best singer, best bass player, keyboard, it never works ever in a million years.
Journey.
Right. Yeah.
It was a Journey and Toto. They were both bands made of session.
Right.
Like session killers, you know, but it like never moved me.
You know, it's like the grain of sand in the oyster, you know, that's what makes the pearl. And if everybody's just, you know, perfectly round, and what you get is music without any character, you know, and the character is what you look for, something different, you know?
When you're kids and you start playing music together, you just sit around and listen to, like, you know, the music that you love and that you're inspired by that seems otherworldly and intimidating. And then you try your best to rip it off in some way, and the way you get it wrong is the best.
Yeah, and that becomes you.
It's the beauty of the mistakes we make, right? The serendipitous moments.
Right. When you start, you're not really good at doing lots of things, so you kind of make your version of it. You know, we did that in The Cure. I couldn't play very complicated drum fills, so I decided to keep it very simple. And that ended up being something that, like a trademark, I suppose.
You know, a professional, there are people around you that stop you from getting it wrong, that protect you from those mistakes. And those mistakes are kind of what matters. There's something great about trying to get it right.
Yeah.
And being wrong, and that's what your sound is. My favorite game is how long ago was that, and what, and from then back, what's that? Like, I'm now getting back involved with my label and like starting up again, the community of people around me. And like when I started DFA, it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, when did you first play with the Banshees?
It was 1979.
So 1999, you already called it quits. That was shorter ago from the end of the Banshees to your first time than I am to the beginning of my label, which seems crazy to me.
Yeah.
It time is compressing in this way. I think culture is moving slower. But you could be like, I could be at a party today and hear the Stooges' Funhouse and be like, okay, great. Doesn't feel dated. It feels...
Right.
You feel like you're in a room full of pretty cool people if they're playing Funhouse. Like, you don't feel like, oh, it's dad. You know, it's like, it feels like... It feels awesome. And that's, what, 1969?
Yeah.
So that's like, before that is what, 1908? You know, like, or, you know what I mean? Like, or 1918.
Yeah.
The same time from Funhouse to now is like the First World War.
Yeah.
If you had played the Stooges to someone at that time, they would have like screamed and covered their ears. But I think things have actually slowed down a bit. I think punk did part, it actually did what it set out to do. Which was kind of just explode music. Think about it. Punk and then post-punk was like 40 minutes later. You know, the ink isn't even wet on pressing the Sex Pistols records and you have Public Image records coming out.
Right.
And that's like, that to me, like Public Image is like, that's like when you're like, okay, that's post-punk clearly because it's the same guy. Like here you have like the guy and then the guy and it's in a suit with makeup on and looking like weirdly model presented and, you know, if nothing could be more like, oh, that's over, than that gesture. I saw a kid the other day, maybe 22, driving around in Brooklyn with a big SUV, pumping hip-hop with auto-tune vocals. And I was like, his dad could have done the exact same thing 20 years ago.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, even hip hop, a music that like reinvented itself minutes after something happened. Like it would be like somebody would say a verse over a beat And then next guy would come up and try to be like, that was old. The thing that happened 18 seconds ago is old. This is the new shit right now. And like constantly reinvent itself and kind of has actually even hit this stasis, like where we're really still using auto-tune vocals. Like it's like, that's a Cher technique from the late 90s.
Right.
Just like hung on.
It's happening in a lot of spheres of life. I'm reading that book, Evil Geniuses, you know, and it's happened in like the political everything. It's happened. It's just like stopped, you know. If you look back at some things in the 90s, the country's exactly the same, you know, the world, the cultural thing's exactly the same now. Whereas when we were in the 70s, you know, rock and roll, when it first started, was only like 20 years before, but it was completely, you know, a different world. And now it's just like... we're stuck.
So where do we go?
I mean, I think what, you know, you go to a certain degree inward. It's like also music is unrooted from some of its other meanings.
Yeah.
It's no longer the protest medium.
Right.
It's no longer the personal identification medium. Mm-hmm. It's no longer where you get all your style. Like when I was a kid, it's like, I was like, the B-52s and the Clash. Yeah, fine. They're weird. It's not... Right. Like I was okay with anything that wasn't like Bon Jovi or like
right, yeah,
wasn't like Three Dog Night and, yeah. and what was on the radio. Like I was just happy for anything that was different. And so you got this like, you know, I'm going to a show and it's like Bad Brains, and then the next night I'm going to see the Violent Femmes, and the next night like things that like on paper would be so incongruous. And I think that's going to be harder to pull off now because. You can get your own special channel.
Right. Just for you, yeah. I'd always been thinking of life as a sort of like linear process with, you know, you do one thing and then another thing happens and another thing happens. You get married and you have a child and you do another thing and another thing happens. And it's not like that at all. In fact, it's like, this concentric circles, you know, and you just fall off of one onto the other to the next one.
We have to also remember you both found some success young.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah.
you landed in your thing.
Yeah.
I did not.
Like, right.
I mean, the first time I made a living, the first time that I didn't pay to make music, the first time that, like, at the end of the year, I didn't have to have a job that wasn't making music. I was 35. So it's like, I have this, I always joke that I do, there's no photos of me young and thin in my band. Like I never have to deal with that thing where like, oh geez, I just see the old photos of us and look at me. Never happened because I was 30 something and 220 pounds. When we started, like, that's who I, it's this joke, like, with that we always joke about that we skipped over the big existential thing that you go through when suddenly you're like, I was a kid and I was, fuck everybody. And then I did this stupid thing that everybody thought was a terrible idea. And look at me, I'm on a plane. Like, you know, like, and then at some point you're like, this will clearly go on forever exactly as it is.
Yes.
What earth could ever stop this train?
Yeah.
Being like, oh,
yeah, I had that illusion.
Why wouldn't you? I think when you succeed in an artistic field, a certain part of you grows a lot. Like you have these crazy experiences and you're like all over the world and you think about what you, where you came from and this like really narrow world. And suddenly you're like in Kyoto and like you're eating food that your family would be horrified by. And, you know, you feel very worldly.
Yes.
But in another way, you are frozen at that age.
Right.
Is there any truth in laying yourself open to music?
Yeah.
May in some way keep you in your childhood. It's like your childhood dream and it becomes your reality.
Yes.
You become Peter Pan-like. You stay in that youth,
because growing up is being wrong makes you grow up.
Yeah,
like being eating shit grows you up. Like that's why kids grow you up, I think, because kids are just like, kids don't give a shit. Like they shit their pants and they're not waiting till you're done with your inspiration. They just shat their pants and that's your fucking problem.
Yeah.
So like that kid thing of like, fuck you guys, I'm doing my thing. The longer that goes on, the longer you're still a kid.
Yeah.
Good ways and the bad ways. And like, I was like holding, literally I had like a little bag of kid dust that every year I'd be like,
throw that away.
Anywhere. Like I just kept this little bag. And I used to joke that, like I said, I only have so much kindling left.
Oh, goodness. James, that is, you know, that's what I told my psychotherapist when everything had blown up. Everything had gone, you know, the marriage, the band, the last vestiges, everything had gone. And I was sitting there with this guy in the consulting room because I thought, better talk to somebody about this. And I said to him, it feels like there's a little vial inside of me with the pure essence of me. And if I just open the top once more to check, that's it. I'm gone. There's been nothing left. And that vial, that essence, was probably me at 15.
Yeah.
And since that point, when I was dreaming of it, around about 20, I mean, 79, so I'll be 22. But I was already with the slits when I was 21. So I'd stopped. And I had to start learning how to be who I am, whoever I am.
Right. I think that's hard. I mean, it's clear that it's hard because history is strewn with like fallen soldiers on that hill. Like that's like a hard, that's a lot of people don't make it out of that place. And like, as much as it sucked to just eat shit for a long time, in some ways I don't know. Like I think it's the best thing ever happened to me because I was the worst. Like I was so cocky. Mm-hmm. Like, so, I mean, I wasn't arrogant in this. I wasn't like type A arrogant. I was quietly alone waiting. Like you all fucking see. Like I know I'm the weird kid in my town, but you're all gonna fucking see. Like wait till I get out of this town, and you'll all see. And I'm gonna just be like, validation would have made me, would have calcified my stubbornness. It is a thing to behold as it is. Like so, it's like at least now it's a bit of a ruin. Like I can't imagine what anxiety I would have fallen prey to, like the fear of it going away. Because I experience it now. Like one of the reasons I tried to scuttle the band was because I could feel that anxiety creeping in.
Yeah.
What if the next record doesn't work? What if someone tries to take this away from me? What if I lose this? And I didn't like that because I was like, oh, that's not a good place to be. That's not a good place to make music from. And so I was like, I'm done. And I'd met my now wife and I was like, I want to go build a life. And I don't know that I can do it while building this because this takes every bit of me. Like this, the kind of selfishness that's required here isn't compatible with like developing a life with someone. And so she had quit her job and I quit my job essentially. And we just kind of like built a life together. I thought I could deny, I mean, it was very childish of me to think like, I'm like, okay, well, I'm just never going to make music again. That's just fine. I'll just run a restaurant. That's what I did. For five years, I fixed air conditioning. And
I went for an interview as a motorcycle courier in London.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I moved over to England. I've lived 15 years in France, you know, isolated and living that lifestyle. I don't know what lifestyle was. It was a big house and nobody in it, really. But I thought, oh, I need to make some money. So I started selling my gear off and then I passed my motorcycle test, which was classic midlife, you know. And then I got on the train from just outside north of London and went for the interview, you know, with all these Polish guys, these ace riders.
Yeah.
And I'm a novice. And I hit like London midday traffic. And they said, the guys afterwards were going, okay, where? You've got the job. When do you want to start? I went, can I think about that for a moment? I didn't go back. I never bought a motorcycle. I still have the crash, you know, I still have the safety helmets, but I never rode again.
Yeah.
You know, that must be your road to Damascus moment, you know. I had mine out here in the middle of the desert. when I first got here. No, what am I? Who am I fooling myself? I have to go back and do this. I have to quell the beast some more, you know. We can't escape, you know. It's kind of like Captain Ahab, you know. It's like, you know, you've got to, at some point, you've got to confront Moby Dick, you know.
I mean, I think success is an interesting challenge.
Yes.
When you're in a thing that's like chugging along and you know how each other work and you're in a successful band that's moving along, you know, like, okay, we got to get some time in the studio. You can say things like that. Someone will be like, you know, you guys need some time in the studio. You need to get another record together. And what this is a career thing. No one ever comes to you and says like creatively, you guys really need to get in the studio. Someone, what they mean is the shine's come off the last record. Have you heard the new record by your contemporaries? The production is moving on. If you don't want to be left behind, you've got to go back in the studio and make something. You've got to address the new challenge.
Right.
From a career position. That transition from like, let's go make music to we got to go make music is really subtle.
Yeah.
Like what, how do I get people to feel that again?
That's the kind of the first place you go.
Yeah. As opposed to this unconscious thing of like, hey, I'm going to go do the thing and it always works out.
Which is where we were at the very beginning. We'll just go and do our thing and it works out. You know, if I think about it from 19 to about 23, that's what we did. Yeah. And it was kind of, it worked. And it's still...
You were riding the zeitgeist that you didn't know was there.
Right.
Like sitting there in like a train.
Yeah.
And like everyone's sitting doing nothing. And all you got to do is get up and walk forward a few cars and you're fucking going... like a rocket.
Right.
If you're willing to go write some song, like you're in a moment that's moving and you're in that moment.
Right.
So it's already propelling you a bit. And like when you get off of that, it's very, I think it's really psychologically so hard to know, like now you have to ask questions from zero.
Yeah. And you're left with yourself.
Yeah. You know? You didn't have to ask questions before. You're like,
it's true. You have to have a point of questioning.
I had that moment, a kind of strange moment when I landed in Berlin and I was 50. I had my 50th birthday floating on a canal in a boat, mind you.
Yeah, not on your back.
No, I'd done that one 20 years earlier, probably face down. And I'm watching this functioning stuff, like the people on the train are all around me. And I feel like, you know, when you see one of those videos where it's like time lapse and somebody's walking backwards, I felt like the person who's static while the world's going on around them. It's taken me a long time. And I don't mean to like say I've caught up with everybody, but that my position is okay.
Yeah.
This static role, this calm interior is okay today. And the craziness just continues, but it's not making me anxious.
Peace of mind, right?
Yeah.
Well, and also you have the advantage of being younger. Like, I mean, you've met people your age and you have that, you've had the moment that all musicians have.
Yeah.
Where you're talking to someone on a plane and you see them and they're like a business person. I mean, they're older than you and they see you and you're younger than them. And then you start talking and you start talking about, well, what do you do? Oh, wow, that's amazing. Well, I do this. And then eventually they say a thing like, well, I mean, you can do that. I mean, when I was younger, and then they look at you and they go, wait, you're older than me, aren't you? Like when something happens, like I am 50. I'm absolutely 50. There's no way if you look at me, you're going to think I'm younger than 50 or older than 50. Like I'm 50. Yeah, I got a certain amount of wrinkles, a certain amount of gray hair. I'm 50. I'm like classically 50. But that's physical.
Mm.
And the way that people present themselves, the way they carry themselves, just the way that your physical, your energy is.
Right.
I have these conversations with people where I'm sitting there talking to them and they say to me like, oh, well, if I was your age, I'd do the thing. And then they look at me and I'm like, I'm 15 years older than you. Like they'll be 35. And they'll suddenly look at each other and I'm like, you don't have any wrinkles. And they're like, you have wrinkles and gray hair. I think I've just spent this last hour talking to you, assuming you're significantly younger than me. And I conversely have had that same experience talking to them where they seem quite old. And as a kid, like, I think I always admired old painters and stuff like that, that had like this like different kind. They were not on a linear track that had any relation to the people around
me. Right.
No.
And I think
maybe that creation is the fountain of youth then, yeah, right?
No. It is.
I do remember contemporaries from school. I rarely went back home to the little town, but when I did, I met people who I used to wait outside their house for them to come out to play. And I met this guy, and I thought, I mean, he looks like the age my dad was. My dad was always to me, he was around 52.
Yeah.
That was my dad's age. He woke home, he was always 52. I don't know why. I don't know how old he was when he died. He was about 70-something. But this young guy looked like everybody else in my town. They looked a certain age.
Yeah.
And they became old around 30.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought, I don't want to do that.
No.
I've got to find a way out.
Well, this was the way out, really. I mean, I remember the same thing. You know, guys in my town that were like between 50 and 60 were one step close to death. You know, that was it. It was all over. I don't feel like that. Mm. You know?
It's just the relationship to the world around you.
Right.
Like having somewhat of a childish relationship to the world around you is both this amazing thing,
right,
and also quite dangerous if you don't learn where to trim it.
Right. Yeah. I can attest to that one.
There's the obvious ways in which it's dangerous because you have poor impulse control and you don't do things that are right. Dangerous. But there's also like kids can grow the most, but they can also be the most resistant to seeing their own flaws. And I think sometimes I meet like people who are just like at all times in a case of self-presentation, like an unwilling to just be embarrassing or to be, like the way a teenager is just sort of like, shut up, mom. Like, don't, you know, like, and you'll meet people and you're like, you're way too grown up for this. Like, aren't you? Like, but there are some people who just are lucky or unlucky in that they have access to themselves that's different. I know some actors who have like they can cry and they don't feel like they're acting. They just like, and they're a little, they're wild and they're sort of like oral stage babies. Like, they're just like, I want that. Give me that. Give me that. And they don't need to be fucked up that crazy.
No.
Like, I'm absolutely not that person. Like, I'm kind of like uptight by nature and like historically needed to be pretty fucked up to act out, which I learned that there's an easy way to do that, to get yourself all super fucked up. But the trick for me is like learning how to like access that stuff from a position of like not destroying myself. Like, but I think other people like don't get stuck even though they're unwilling to grow. They can continue to, because they have such, they can just like look down and they see everything they are.
Right.
Like, I'm going to pull this out with confidence. And it's got nothing to do with like, whereas for me, it's a little bit like the voice that says, you're doing the right thing. This is what, who you are. Follow it. Is this quiet little voice in me.
So I suppose getting older, I've realized sometimes that quiet voice inside you is not just the inner critic. Sometimes that quiet voice is right and you should follow it.
It's an interesting concept. Maybe that little voice was always there, but the youthful us just didn't want to pay attention to it. No. What are you talking about? No, my way's better.
Pleasure to talk to you guys. Like,
yeah, I judge people about, like, if I meet them and I think, okay, could I spend eternity in a windowless room with this person? Yeah. You know? Yeah, you pass the test.
Oh, good. Yeah. Been really great way to end it, be like, and no, I think this is 2 hours is my limit.
That's it. It's that time of the show, Lol. We got to answer some questions from the fans. Chris Rose. Don't know where Chris is from, but Lol, he's got a question.
Okay.
He says, Lol, do you still have and still use your rototoms?
Ah, the rototoms.
What are rototoms?
Well, back in the day, I decided I wanted a more unusual drum kit because there was like two kinds of drum kits there. There was ones with tom-toms that had bottom head on, and ones that were called concert toms that had only one head. And that was kind of it. And I was kind of fed up with them. So I saw these things in, I don't know, one of the drum shops in London, rotor toms, which were just a head in a metal frame. And you could tune the drum by moving the head around. And that seemed like a really cool idea to me. And I was sort of inspired a little bit by seeing Ginger Baker on this documentary out in Africa somewhere. And he had a talking drum that he was holding under his arm. And by various points of pressure, he was changing the tone and, you know, gibbering at us incomprehensibly and playing it. But it was really interesting. So I thought, well, I could do something like that on it. And then I thought, well, why don't I just make the whole kit like that? Which I did, except for the kick drum.
And the kick drum and the snare drum.
Oh, yes, the snare drum. That's true. It's very true.
Because I of course, know what rotor toms are. And the first time I saw them, right. really saw them. Was yes. you when I just joined the Banshees, the Cure were opening, yeah. and I got to see you sound check, and I was that's when I got a close look at this yeah. rack of rototoms and that huge snare, deep, big, deep right. military marching snare,
which I bought off of John Bradbury from the Specials.
Ah, nice.
He had two of them, and he didn't want them because they didn't. So he wanted sort of that rude boy high ping sound, you know, and that wasn't going to give it to him. So he sold me both of them.
The rotor toms, did they help you to find your sound in a way?
Well, they helped me find patterns. I mean, later on in things like All Cats Are Grey on Faith, it was a compositional tool for me to have the rotor toms. So I liked them very much.
In fact, the rotor tom is there was no shell, just the hoop which you like an old steering wheel, but you could tune to quite specific notes, right? You could get notes going.
Yeah, I often think that people don't think that they don't think of drums being tuned in a musical way at all. They sort of imagine that they just sort of they're there. But for a lot of music, you can really enhance it by tuning your drums to be in sympathy with the music you're playing. And so rotor toms were much easier to do that for me, you know, for the Cure's music. And you imagine then there was only three of us as well. So there was a lot of sonic space that you could occupy. You weren't going to get drowned out. Do I have the rotor toms anymore? I don't have my original rotor toms because all my equipment went into this huge lockup in the middle of John Henry's in North London. And when I left the band, it somehow, you know, got transported to a different galaxy. I never saw anything ever again.
We got another one.
Yeah.
It's Louis Caceres. Okay. And
yeah.
for both of us, it says, you two must have had your eyes and ears on the other drummers, also playing post-punk goth rock music. What drummer's style or playing did you admire the most?
Well, there was two from the punk time. I mean, I like Jet Black.
Jet Black was the drummer with?
The Stranglers.
Yes.
Yeah. I liked his playing very much. And I also liked Tony Chimes before Topper. And that's how I would take the first Clash album along to my drum teacher, Andy McBride, and tell him, teach me how to play these.
Okay. Well, you've already mentioned yeah. one of mine, of course, because my first real taste of, London and the bands I'd seen from a distance. I'd seen the Ramones, I'd seen right. Talking Heads, I'd seen the early Pistols in Liverpool. Right. But the band that really kind of took me was The Clash.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. so when I got the chance, when I was, the Slits were opening for The Clash on the Sort It Out tour. And right. so I was at side stage every night watching Topper. Amazing. Just watching really what I didn't know at the time, but I know now looking back, I was watching an exemplary lesson in what drumming, being a drummer in a band was all about.
Right.
Yeah, that was great. And it was a big help to me. So yeah, I had a secret admiration. And the other guy was, and you can probably tell me his name. It's the drummer with XTC.
Oh, Terry Chambers.
It is Terry Chambers. I was thinking of Martin Chambers, who's in yeah. The Pretenders still.
Yeah, no, Terry Chambers was really, really good as well.
I mean, he had a big kit, big toms.
The gigantic yeah. toms. Gigantic toms that Andy Partridge used to stick his yep. head inside. but on stage, which is kind of nuts.
I still listen to, because I remember the songs, and I listen back now with new ears, like a drummer looking back at drums and going, he was so inventive. He made beats that, and I'm sure, got to me. They got to me in a way I thought, okay, there's something going on here that's really quite different. And I could still listen to Only Making Plans for Nigel and try and figure out how the drums go in. You know, you know, I thought of another drummer from that time that was almost certainly an influence, because it was the first I'd heard any of that music recorded. It was John Mayer with the Buzzcocks.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely.
And I was hearing, like, that was that song. It was called, was it called Heartbeat? Dubba dubba dum, dubba dubba dum, ba bum, dubba dubba dum, dubba dubba dum, ba bum, dubba dubba dum, dubba dubba dum, ba. And something like that.
Yeah.
And he was also very flat cymbals. It looked and sounded a lot like Clem Burke's kit.
Right, right.
Two very different approaches to drumming.
You know, I remember, Budgie, going to see the Buzzcocks with you and Sue and Severin one night up in Manchester. We had a night off and we all went down to see them. Remember that?
Carry on.
Yeah. Well, that's about all I actually remember of it. So
yes, I want to remember it. I want to remember. Yes, of course I remember it. I was there. I remember that. Yeah, great night out. Buzzcocks, yes. I had many good nights out. Me and Pete Shelley, we had some great nights. I can't remember any of them. They were great, though.
Yeah. Curious Creatures is created and presented by Bol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Spare.
Social media, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
I love saying www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com. And you can reach us on Instagram, Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram and at doubleelvisfm on Twitter. Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2021.